You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the very proximate future, women in the United States will cross the statistical threshold to constitute more than 50% of the paid workforce, a fact recently highlighted on the cover of the hyper-capitalist Economist magazine titled, We Did It. Presumably, this is a victory that the feminist movement should celebrate outright. Or are things perhaps a bit more complicated? Joining me to take apart the complex legacy of feminism today, after three decades of what has come to be known as neoliberal capitalism, is Nancy Fraser. She's an acclaimed feminist theorist, author of many books, including Redistribution or Recognition, A Political-Philosophical Exchange, and Scales of Justice, Reimagining Political Space in a Globalizing World. She teaches at the New School for Social Research and has written a piece in the New Left Review titled Feminism, Capitalism, and the Cunning of History. Nancy Fraser joins me on the phone from New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
So before we get to the argument that you make in this essay in the New Left Review, I wonder if you could lay out for us the standard position one hears about feminism's successes and failures, or maybe better said lags, since the heyday of what is known as second wave feminism of the early 1970s.
Sure. I think most people hold the view that feminism was a great success at one level, but remains a bit incomplete at another level. The successful level is the level of attitudes. I think it's fair to say, and many people believe, that feminist ideas about women's equality, about the desirability of changing society to enable women to participate fully in social life on terms of parity with men, the attitudes, beliefs like this are increasingly widespread. But the standard view would be we haven't succeeded yet in translating those beliefs into new social policies, new social institutions, new social structures. So the standard view is successful change in ideas, but still lagging progress when it comes to changing institutions.
Sure. So before we get into some depth about the ideas of the time, can you tell us about second wave feminism's origins?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember is that second wave feminism really burst on the scene as a very, very radical countercultural social movement. It grew out of the ferment of the New Left in the late 1960s and 1970s in the United States, but also quickly spreading elsewhere. And the point is that this was a very radical time in the country. It was a time when people were rejecting what we thought of as the system, politics as usual. The idea was that the standard politics of the liberal welfare state really was restrictive. It didn't give enough room for the kinds of questions that feminists cared about. So very much on the heels of the New Left, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, feminism erupted, and it shared this general sense of a critique of the whole system of life in modern liberal capitalist societies and desire for very deep-seated structural change. It was quite a radical movement. I think we tend to forget that because, you know, in the interim, it's been transformed into something more like a familiar interest group. But that was not the origin.
I wonder if you could expand on the type of society, the type of capitalism that characterized both what was known at the time as the First World and the Third World in the years that feminism, second wave feminism, arose.
Yes. I think of feminism as really bursting on the scene in the midst of what you might call a social democratic form of capitalism, in which states played a very, very active role in managing and steering their national economies. So we are familiar, of course, with the European welfare states, which in many ways were more developed than our own. But what the U.S. System shared with those other countries was the idea that it was the responsibility of the state to manage the business cycle, to soften the sort of boom-bust alternation that had always seemed to be endemic in a capitalist society. And states were, it was thought, were able to manage that cycle by, well, we hear similar talk today, stimulating demand, that is, giving workers more money to spend to buy products, in some cases by nationalizing industry. In other cases, by redistributive taxation, by all sorts of ways of trying to direct investment. So the idea was, and this was a break from earlier forms of laissez-faire capitalism, the idea was that the market wouldn't work properly as an invisible hand left to itself. It required this kind of active management and steering. That, I think, is the kind of capitalism that emerged at the end of the Second World War and that was in force for several decades, including at this period of new left radicalism and the emergence of the second wave that I just described. That capitalism, of course, has since been superseded by a new form, or maybe a return to an older form, which we call neoliberalism, but is a much more laissez-faire style of capitalism that is much less favorable to state direction of the economy.
So take us through the feminist critique of state organized capitalism in the late 60s that you've been describing, and the various ways that feminists saw the oppression of women manifested.
Yeah. I think that in my article, I sort of identified four aspects of this kind of capitalism that became the target of intense feminist critique and contestation with the eruption of the second wave. And the first of these characteristics I called economism. And what I mean by that is a tendency to treat all political issues, all questions of justice and injustice, as if they could simply be solved by a little bit of economic redistribution. And this kind of economism, that is, of seeing all political problems through the lens of the economy in this narrow sense, this view clearly left no room for issues like the politics of sexuality, of housework, domestic violence, sexual harassment, so many of the forms of male dominance that the second wave was discovering and publicizing and creating names for. These were new social problems that did not have a language and basically burst open the culture of state-organized capitalism, which, as I said, reduced everything to economics. And these were issues that couldn't be reduced to economics. They were a sign, in my view, that there was a whole other order of subordination that could not be reduced to economic structure the way that, let's say, Marxists or social democrats had assumed.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Nancy Fraser. She is the author of an essay in the New Left Review titled Feminism, Capitalism, and the Cunning of History, which is the topic of our discussion today. You can find a link to that essay on our website, againstthegrain.org. She is professor of political and social science at the New School for Social Research in New York. So Nancy, as you were just saying, one of the characteristics of this period was what you term economism, this focus on redistribution through class without a developed attention at all to gender or race and so on. Another dimension that feminists focused on at the time had to do with the organization of society as a top-down, managerial, technocratic state. Tell us about that dimension.
Yes, exactly. I think it's fair to say that in these welfare states, this form of state-organized capitalism that was the original context for the emergence of second-wave feminism, there was a very depoliticized, what you might call expertocratic political culture. This was a society that assumed that social scientists, effectively social engineers, government bureaucrats, and so on, would be able, based on supposedly scientific knowledge, right, to sort of understand the problems, to craft solutions, and then to hand them down to a relatively passive population who were treated as the objects rather than the subjects of the political process. And those of your listeners who remember the days of the New Left will remember very clearly the great interest in participatory democracy as an alternative to this kind of administrative welfare state that seemed to disempower the very people that it was supposedly helping. And all of the new social movements of this period that we're talking about were very opposed to this kind of technocratic culture. And feminism was no exception. All of the great innovations that second wave feminists developed at the level of practice and organizational forms, like consciousness raising groups, these were all intended as alternatives to that bureaucratic culture of the welfare state. They all aimed at empowering people in small group participatory forms. So second wave feminism, like much of the New Left, had a strong critique of this kind of state bureaucratic ethos in the welfare state. There is another point, and that's what I would like to call the critique of androcentrism. And what I mean by that is a kind of set of assumptions that are not really questioned but have become, you know, second nature and just go without saying, that assume that the ideal typical citizen is simply a man, and that therefore assumes that, you know, the way institutions are designed is premised on this notion that that's who the citizen is. So taking the male as norm, as feminists used to say in that era, that's the idea of androcentrism. And of course, when you design institutions on the tacit assumption of the male as the norm, you end up disadvantaging women in all kinds of ways, intended or unintended. And this was a really major part of the second wave feminist critique of the state-organized capitalist societies that we've been discussing, because the whole design of the welfare state was premised on the idea that the ideal typical citizen was a quote-unquote worker, meaning a waged worker, and ideally that was supposed to be a man whose wages were supposed to be the sole economic support of his family. Of course, even in those days, many women did wage work, but the assumption was that their wages were merely supplementary. And this idea, the so-called family wage idea, that the man should earn enough to support the whole family without the woman having to do wage work or anything more than merely supplementary wage work, that idea was built into the whole structure of the American welfare state, of the much-praised Scandinavian welfare states, of all of these state-organized capitalist societies that we've been discussing. And this critique, the critique of this kind of androcentrism, of taking the male as the norm, was an absolutely central focus of second wave feminism.
And then a final dimension that you point to is the focus, the critique of the nation state being the arena of politics. And some of this seems to come out of the opposition to the Vietnam War, if I'm correct.
Yes, because, you know, from everything we've been saying so far, it follows that this was a form of capitalism that, even though it was premised on free trade at the international level, it was still based on the idea of a national economy, which, right, in each case, the state should be managing, and in each case, right, the members of society were the citizens of this territorial state, and it was among them that questions of justice or injustice arose. So the sort of built-in assumption was that if you're going to get politically involved and raise claims and critique your society, where you're doing it within the domestic national frame. Who are you addressing your claims to? Your fellow citizens, and through them to your state. That was a very strong part of the state organized capitalism of this period. And it's one that I think feminists had a somewhat ambivalent relation to. You're absolutely right that one of the most important aspects of the time was the critique of imperialism that had been spurred by the Vietnam War. So new leftists of all stripes, feminists and otherwise, had a very strong critique of imperialism and a strong sense of solidarity with those whom we in those days called, you know, the Third World liberation movements and so on. So feminism emerged in that atmosphere and definitely took on some of this anti-imperialist quality, which tended to break open the idea that the national state was the sole or principal legitimate arena of politics. On the other hand, I think at that time there was did not exist, certainly not to the extent we have today, the sort of means of technological communication, the forms of transnational networking, and all of that to translate this anti-imperialist intuition into a real transnational or global practice. So when push came to shove, it was most feminists were still operating within the national state context, were still addressing their demands to their own states. But there was nevertheless this idea that that in the best of all worlds, these kinds of boundaries should not constrain our understanding of politics and, above all, of the forms of entrenched injustices in a capitalist society, that it had to be possible to look at the structures and processes that transgress borders and that, you know, have such a profound impact on people's lives.
Well, the critique that you've been laying out, that the feminist movement put forward in the late 60s, 1970s, as I think you've alluded to, very much come out of the New Left, and yet there were tensions within the New Left around certain dimensions of the critique. I wonder if for a moment you could talk about those tensions.
Clearly, you know, the first thing to note is that many of the early members of the second wave feminist movement were activists who had been involved in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war movement, in the student movement like SDS, and who were chafing at what they perceived and experienced as the sexism of their male comrades and colleagues. And even Beyond that, there was a sense that as the feminists in these other movements began to develop their analysis and their critique of the forms of sexism and women's subordination in society, they found that their male colleagues, or at least some of them, were unwilling to really take these issues as seriously as feminists insisted they be taken. They were considered secondary or in some cases just, you know, funny and you know, not serious. And so the second wave emerged. A lot of its initial energies came from this break within the left in which women found that they had to develop their own movement in order to really have the space and the freedom to develop their ideas and fight for them. But I think the important thing to stress here is that in this early period, there was a strong sense of among the feminists I've been talking about, that they remained on the left. They somehow, despite these tensions and difficulties that they had with other parts of the left, they felt still themselves to be a part of the left. And we could identify certain currents of feminism who, in the end, you could say, responded to the tensions by effectively leaving the left. But certainly the currents that we called socialist feminism and many feminists of color continued to think of themselves as people who were both feminist and anti-racist and anti-capitalist, who wanted a very profound change in society.
One of the things that you have spoken about was the component of a grassroots impulse within feminism at that time. In the New Left, in the late 60s and the 70s, there was certainly a strain which was not simply rejecting of the top-down bureaucratic managerial state, but the state more broadly. Did second wave feminism feed into that, or was that not a critique that by and large was accepted by second wave feminists?
Well, I think it's a complicated question. There was certainly in the New Left a kind of, we could use for want of a better word, an anarchist strain that really hoped somehow to do altogether without, you know, large-scale administrative institutions. I think that feminists, for the most part, were less likely to go down that road than some of their male colleagues. I mean, there was a strand of feminism, that a kind of radical cultural feminism, that saw the whole problem of bureaucracy and administration in a complex society as simply a male style thing, and that rejected it on that basis. But I think that there were also important feminist currents that thought that given the kinds of private powers, the powers of corporations, both national and multinational, that it would be very necessary to build strong public counterpowers to keep those private powers in check. And feminists who thought in these terms, and other leftists who thought in these terms, were not at all interested in dismantling the welfare state, but rather in democratizing it and transforming it into a much more participatory and empowering institution. But there was, in other words, in this period, not the sense that the state is the problem and we can just get rid of it. There was a strong intuition that whatever problems there were with the state, one also had the problem of the market and the corporations. And it was hard to imagine a counterpower that could keep a check on the corporations and the private economic interests without some kind of strong state. The question then was, what kind of state? Is it possible to, as I say, democratize it in a radical way?
I'm Sasha Lilly. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. My guest is Nancy Fraser, noted feminist thinker and critical theorist. She is a professor of political and social science at the New School for Social Research in New York and is the author of numerous books, including Scales of Justice, Reimagining Political Space in a Globalizing World, and Mapping the Radical Imagination Between Redistribution and Recognition. She's the author of an essay in the New Left Review titled Feminism, Capitalism, and the Cunning of History, which is the subject of our program today. You can find a link to that essay on againstthegrain.org. Perhaps the most enduring legacy of the New Left was the feminist movement. And yet it went from being a relatively small countercultural movement to being something that has had global dimensions, that's changed societies in many ways. Before we talk about how that came to pass, that massive transformation, I wonder if you could describe for us neoliberalism, the shift in capitalism, which came of age at basically the same moment as second wave feminism in the early 1970s.
Yeah, I think this is really, in a way, the most important point that I want to try to make. And the point is that second wave feminism originated in one phase, one kind of capitalist society, the state-organized kind we've been discussing. But something else was going on underneath at the same time, parallel to the development of the feminist movement in the subsequent decades, and that was the transformation of state-organized capitalism into this new form that we call neoliberalism. And really my point, the question that I'm trying to explore here is, how did feminism change as this form of capitalism was changing? And in what ways did feminism contribute, in fact, to the development of a new form of capitalism? Well, let me first describe, as you asked, the neoliberal idea. And that's the idea that the market, not the state, is and should be the leading institution of society. It's the best way to coordinate social action. It's the most efficient. It's the most democratic, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a set of ideas, neoliberalism, that basically wants to deregulate and dismantle the forms of public power, the regulatory agencies, and the policies that the so-called Keynesian state-managed capitalism had been using. So what we got in this period was the idea that the welfare state should give way to the so-called lean, mean competition state that would be simply trying to cut red tape and get the government out of the way of business so that it could do its thing and the benefits would presumably trickle down to everyone. So there's a kind of aggressive policy of marketizing, of deregulating, and of privatizing where there are state-owned industries or other assets. Probably your listeners are familiar with the policies that have been discussed a lot of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which have foisted this kind of agenda, this neoliberal agenda, onto the countries of the developing world as a condition for receiving loans. So these countries have basically, as a condition of receiving loans, they've been forced to privatize their nationalized industries, to slash social spending, and in various other ways implement this kind of privatization and marketizing policy. And that these policies have been somewhat unevenly implemented differently in one place as opposed to another. But nevertheless, overall, there has been a rather significant shift in the form of capitalism that we live in. And as you rightly note, there's a very interesting coincidence that has not been sufficiently explored. And that is the fact, what does it mean that capitalism transformed in this way in the same period as feminism was undergoing its development? What is the relation between these two important social transformations?
And before we get into looking at some of the points you made earlier in the hour and seeing how feminism may have inadvertently fed into the emergence of neoliberalism, can you give us some concrete examples of feminism and neoliberalism intersecting?
Yes. My claim in this article is that the four critiques that we just discussed earlier took on a new feel, a new inflection as the form of capitalism changed. It was one thing to criticize a welfare state that was top-down and bureaucratic, that was too focused on exclusively economic and class inequalities, that neglected gender, race, and forms of status inequality. It was one thing to criticize androcentrism, the taking of the male as the norm in the design of the welfare state. One thing to make these critiques when you actually had, right, a robust and strong working welfare state. But at the moment when neoliberalism emerged to challenge the welfare state, to put it on the defensive, these same critiques coming from feminists and from other progressive movements took on a different quality. They were available, you could say, to be used, to be instrumentalized in a way that seemed to be piling on to the critique of the state and, by implication, supporting the market against the state. So we remember, for example, the Margaret Thatcher's critique of the so-called nanny state. Well, her idea was to simply marketize, to deregulate. But it was not the same idea that feminists had. When we criticized the masculinist or bureaucratic character of welfare states. But you can sort of see how there could be a kind of a dovetailing of these ideas, unintended by anybody, for sure, but nevertheless troubling. And the same is true with the critique of the idea of the worker, the male worker, as the ideal typical citizen. Just as neoliberalism was really trying heavily to recruit women into wage work, and indeed that's one of the most important facts about this new capitalism, is that it is much more heavily dependent on women's wage work than earlier forms. And you just noted that today we have this astounding statistics that show that women's labor force participation has very recently in the United States eclipsed men's. Well, we know that that's because men have been very hard hit by the recession, but it also says something about the kinds of employment, the low-wage service sector, for example, which is a woman-dominated sector of the economy, is very central to neoliberalism, just as we have the decline of manufacturing and of those unionized, higher-paying jobs in the United States. So the point then is, neoliberalism wants women workers. Feminism, in part, underwent a subtle shift. What was at first understood as a critique of capitalism's overemphasis on wage labor, its neglect of unwaged activities like caregiving, that transmuted into some kind of new feminist push for entry into the workplace. And so we have all the rhetoric about at the sort of professional managerial end of the spectrum, women have to crack the glass ceiling. And at the other end, we have all these women who enter the workforce in low-wage service sectors, jobs who are, you know, there obviously because they need the money, but also have a sense of finding there some self-esteem, some kind of relative liberation from the traditional authority of fathers and husbands. And so this is an example of how a critique of male domination in the design of social life in state-organized capitalism has been transmuted into a kind of new love affair with the market, with wage work, and that is awfully convenient for neoliberalism.
And you have been touching on this already, but I wonder if we could revisit the points that you made before, the four pillars of the feminist critique against economism, against androcentrism, seeing men as the key players in society, the managerial top-down dimension to state-managed capitalism, and the dimension of the nation-state being the arena of political contestation. How did those feminist critiques give fuel to the new neoliberal order? You've already been talking about how it affected the notion of the market versus the state and wage work, but what about the other dimensions of that initial critique?
Yeah, I think in each case, the critique which had, let's say, a radically transformative character in the context of state-organized capitalism became much more problematic in terms of the way it operated, the way it played in the new context of neoliberalism. So, as I've already said, the critique of bureaucracy gets transmuted into let's get the lean, mean state, let's deregulate, and then that, in effect, becomes the romance of the market. The critique of androcentrism, which was never in the early days of the second wave about valorizing wage labor, gets transmuted into this kind of love affair with wage labor as the sort of key thrust of the struggle for women's equality. That is a second example. And in terms of the idea of the critique of the earlier kind of capitalism's focus on economic distributive questions, what happens, I think, with feminism is that feminism takes a highly cultural turn. What the idea, I think, originally was that you want to add all of these other issues about about the culture, about the status order, issues like violence, sexuality, housework, reproduction. You want to add those to the mix about economic inequality. But in effect, what happened was not that. What happened was that more and more the economic just tended to drop out. And so that this is another case in which a critique of economism in a context where you have a state that's paying attention to the economy and trying to fight economic injustice becomes a sort of, I don't know, a diversion and an escape from that. And that, too, is very, very convenient for neoliberalism. The last point about the national state is the most complicated for me, because feminism made the transnational turn, became truly international as all of the as the whole field of politics changed in relation to neoliberalism. I mean, nowadays, many social movements are transnational. We have politics going on at multiple sites and multiple scales in the world, not only in the national arena, but also regional politics, if you think of NAFTA or the EU, the European Union, and, of course, the huge UN and UN-associated meetings, including the ones that were so important for international feminism over the last years, from Nairobi to Beijing and so on. So there's a strong sense now in which the national state is not the only game in town. And I think that has both... It is both a kind of positive and a negative, and too much of the involvement of feminists, and this is less true in the United States perhaps than in Europe, too much of the feminist engagement with the European Union is, again, is dovetailing with the building of a new kind of capitalism. It represents less a critique of that than a kind of contribution to it, we might say. And you could look at things like microcredit in the developing world, which is advertised as a feminist project. And it's absolutely true that we have all kinds of anecdotal stories about how women who have borrowed under these schemes have been able to improve and transform their lives. But the point I want to stress is that this is all going on in the context of state retrenchment and this aggressive project of marketization. So the huge interest in microcredit is somehow suggesting that this can solve women's poverty and third world poverty in general, when in fact it, of course, cannot.
So then the question remains, is this simply a coincidence, the rise of neoliberalism and this ideology intersecting, taking parts of a feminist critique? If it's not simply neoliberalism's boring of convenient rhetoric, what is the dynamic at the heart of this phenomenon?
Yeah, it's a very deep and difficult and, to me, passionately interesting question. Because the easy thing to say would be, as you suggested, it's a coincidence, these two powerful streams of thought, feminist on the one hand, neoliberal on the other hand, ended up developing in tandem over the last 30 years. And feminist ideas were there and were powerful and had quite a lot of charisma, you can say. And neoliberalism borrowed that charisma. It found it lying around and dressed itself up in a kind of feminist guise in a way that feminists themselves might not at all approve or even be horrified by, almost like, you know, George W. Bush saying that he's, you know, invading Afghanistan in order to liberate Afghan women. So that would be the easy read that, okay, we've just kind of been, our movement has been sort of hijacked by this, you know, juggernaut, this powerful, other stream of development. And there might be good reason to think that that's true, but I would like to explore another hypothesis which goes a bit deeper than that of mere coincidence. And the second hypothesis would be that there actually is a certain kind of affinity between feminism and neoliberalism. The affinity is that both of them represent critiques of traditional authority, let us say the forms of authority that you find in traditional communities that could involve the power of the local wealthy landlords, the church in whatever religious civilization we're talking about, the power of elders, of fathers, of husbands, and so on, male authority. Now, clearly, ever since Mary Wollstonecraft, if not before, one important target of feminist critique has been precisely this kind of traditional male authority. And whatever else feminism aims to do, it certainly aims to liberate women from that kind of power, and rightly so. But the problem is that in many contexts, capitalism finds this sort of traditional authority also a problem. It finds it as an obstacle to the further unfolding and penetration of the market. Traditional authority has often put restraints on what can be bought and sold by whom, on what terms, whether these are religious ideas or hierarchies that prevent market activities, and so on. So capitalism in its history has had its own struggle with traditional authority, which it wants to sweep away, and so that we can have only, right, this seemingly equal contractual relations between free individuals. Now, if that's true, then you can see that there is a kind of troubling affinity underlying neoliberalism and feminism. And my thought is that we should take this very seriously, because we really need to think hard about how to respond to that, how to position ourselves as feminists in such a way that we don't let this affinity unfold kind of behind our backs in ways that we don't want it to. So my thought is that that we need to sort of focus on the forms of women's subordination and male domination that do not take the form of these traditional hierarchical relations, but that precisely take the form of abstract, impersonal structures, like market structures, because that's where we really diverge from neoliberalism. Neoliberalism wants nothing more than to replace traditional authority with markets. We should be saying we want to replace traditional authority, but not with markets, with something else. And if we were able to sort of recognize the point at which there seems to be a certain kind of convergence between our views and neoliberalism, then we would be in a better position to figure out how to separate ourselves, how to draw the lines, how to insist that when we criticize this androcentrism and this bureaucratic managerial quality of social democracy, we are not doing it for the sake of the market. We have another aim in view.
Well, in the 2 minutes we have remaining, I want to ask you if you feel like this moment that we're living through now, where neoliberalism is in some sort of crisis, it's not entirely clear what will happen, if it will reconstitute itself, but it seems pretty indisputable that at least the ideology of neoliberalism, of free markets, of markets being a mechanism for empowerment and so on, has been discredited. What sort of opportunity does this moment hold, as you see it, for a renewed feminism of the more radical stripe, perhaps, that you're laying out?
Well, I think that it's actually potentially a very interesting moment, because there's nothing like a crisis to sort of concentrate the mind and to say, okay, now that that the grave problems with neoliberalism, its destruction of communities, its laying waste to nature, its inability to guarantee even the basic necessities for billions of people all over the world. Now that all of this has become clear, we might, as feminists, try to think ourselves back and regain some of the sort of radical energy and thinking that I believe feminism, second wave feminism, at its inception expressed. So I think it's a time where we should try to break these spurious links that have been forged somehow behind our backs between feminism and neoliberalism. We should break the spurious link between our critique of the economism of social democracy and a kind of one-sided focus on culture that ignores economic inequality. We should break the spurious link between our critique of top-down, managerial, bureaucratic political structures and the romance of the market. We should try to break the spurious link between our critique of the so-called the family wage and the new romance of the two-earner family, which is the new neoliberal model. These are all ways in which our critique has gotten merged with these other ideas, and this is a great moment now to insist that our ideas don't have to go in that direction and can be taken in a different direction.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Nancy Fraser. She teaches at the New School for Social Research in New York, is the author of numerous books, including Scales of Justice, Reimagining Political Space in a Globalizing World. She's a noted feminist thinker and critical theorist, and the author of an essay in New Left Review titled Feminism, Capitalism, and the Cunning of History. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening today, and please tune in again for Against the Grain next Monday. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or consider becoming a fan of Against the Grain Radio on Facebook.